I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. The head of the United Nations says U.S. President Donald Trump's proposal to move all Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip would be ethnic cleansing. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
At a meeting of the General Assembly Committee supporting Palestinian rights, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said,
"It is vital to stay true to the bedrock of international law. It is essential to avoid any form of ethnic cleansing."
He did not mention President Trump. Just earlier, UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric was asked if the Secretary General believes Trump's plan for the US to clean out and take over Gaza is ethnic cleansing. He replied,
"Any forced displacement of people is tantamount to ethnic cleansing.
Guterres stressed that any lasting peace will require an end to Israeli occupation of Gaza, the West Bank and East Jerusalem and progress towards a two-state solution. I'm Karen Chamas.
A U.S. judge on Thursday temporarily blocked the Trump administration's proposal to federal workers until at least Monday, giving an initial win to labor unions who have sued to stop it. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Federal workers are under pressure from the Trump administration to leave their jobs in an unprecedented drive to overhaul the government. Workers had faced a midnight deadline to make their decision. The offer promises to pay employees salaries until October, but that may not be ironclad. Current spending laws expire on March 14th, and there is no guarantee that salaries will be funded beyond that point. Many Democrats and labor unions said the offer is not trustworthy.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. This is VOA News. Some South African organizations that assist people with HIV are in limbo after the United States put a 90-day freeze on most foreign aid. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said he wants to bring the agency's activities in line with the new government's America First agenda. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa has the highest number of HIV-positive people in the world, about 8 million, but has also been a huge success story in terms of treatment and preventing new infections. That's largely due to the money poured into expert HIV care here, some 17% of which comes from a U.S. program called the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. But a 90-day foreign aid funding freeze is in effect, following an executive order by President Trump last month, while the State Department has issued a waiver to continue paying for life-saving services. What that includes remains unclear to many South African organizations that receive funding from PEPFAR. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said this week that the waiver was clear.
If it saves lives, if it's emergency life-saving aid, food, medicine, whatever, they have a waiver. I don't know how much clearer we can be.
The South African government says it was blindsided by the U.S. aid freeze, according to Health Minister Aaron Motsoaledi, who convened a meeting about PEPFAR on Wednesday. Motsoaledi also said he has sought clarification on the waiver.
If you say American money cannot be used for LGBTQI+, and we do the counseling and testing, and somebody who falls within that category is transgender, test HIV positive, can they not be helped, even if it's life-saving?
On Wednesday, a group of health organizations sent a letter to the South African government saying at least 900,000 patients with HIV were directly affected by the U.S. stop work orders. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
President Trump's move to freeze most foreign aid has also brought health care services to a halt at refugee camps on the Thai-Myanmar border. Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones reports.
A group of Thai medics battled to save the life of elderly Myanmar refugee Adabi. Previously, the US-funded International Rescue Committee would have treated her and the tens of thousands of other refugees living in camps on the Thai-Myanmar border. But President Trump's freeze on most foreign aid has forced seriously ill patients like Adabi to rely on Thailand's state-run facilities instead. Last week, the government vowed to support refugee healthcare following the US's aid suspension.
Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, February 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Secretary General makes a personal appeal for peace in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo.
My message is clear. Silence the guns. Stop the escalation. Respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Meanwhile, leaders of the Southern African Development Community and the East Africa Community meet today, Friday, to discuss the conflict in eastern DRC. Senegal plans to rename public places once named after French colonial figures. Some NGOs that work with HIV-positive communities in South Africa are in limbo after Washington puts a 90-day freeze on aid.
People are frustrated. They live in fear. They don't know what's going to happen. They don't know is whether it's stopped temporary or not temporary.
And women in Darfur face sexual violence, war, and refuge. Those stories about Samson O'Malley's force are coming up on Daybreak Africa. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has made a personal appeal for peace in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC. He spoke Thursday at the UN headquarters in New York as leaders from the Southern African Development Community, SADC, and the East Africa Community, ESC, are meeting Friday and Saturday in Tanzania to discuss the conflict in the region.
I want to make a special appeal for peace. Thousands of people have been killed, including women and children, and hundreds of thousands have been forced from their homes in the eastern DRC. We also see the continued threats by other armed groups, either Congolese or foreign. All of this is having an enormous human toll. We have countless reports of human rights abuses, including sexual and gender-based violence, forced recruitment, and the disruption of life-saving aid. The humanitarian situation in and around Goma is perilous. Hundreds of thousands of people are on the move, with many of the previous sites hosting displaced people north of the city now looted, destroyed, or abandoned. Healthcare facilities are overwhelmed, and other basic services, including schools, water, electricity, phone lines, and internet, are severely limited. Meanwhile, the conflict continues to rage in South Kivu and risks engulfing the entire region. I want to pay tribute to all those who have lost their lives, including MONUSCO Blue Helmets and regional forces. And I express my solidarity with the Congolese people who find themselves yet again the victims of seemingly endless cycle of violence. As the summit in Tanzania gets underway, and as I prepare to leave for Addis Ababa, my message is clear. Silence the guns. Stop the escalation. Respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Uphold international human rights law and international humanitarian law. There is no military solution. It's time for all the signatories of the peace, security, and cooperation framework for the DRC and the region to honor their commitments. It's time for mediation. It's time to end this crisis. It's time to peace. The stakes are too high, and we need the active and constructive role of all players, namely neighboring countries, sub-regional organizations, the African Union, and the United Nations. Let us all act together for peace.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking Thursday at UN headquarters in New York. Leaders of the Southern African Development Community and the East Africa Community are meeting today, Friday and Saturday, to discuss the conflict in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The DRC is a member of both the SADC and the EAC, while Rwanda is a member of only the East African Community. SADC and the EAC have both put forth separate mediation efforts, the Nairobi peace process and the Luanda peace process. Professor Sipo Sipi is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He explains to me the two approaches to the DRC process.
Well, I think the first thing that we must acknowledge is that the SADC as well as EAC, the Eastern African Community, had been engaged in this process of DRC, and that it is has been an ongoing thing spanning almost the last 60 years. The DRC has never been at peace. But what is most important is to note that the Eastern African Community was earlier involved in this exercise of trying to bring peace and to keep peace in the DRC. And its mandate was very clear. It was a political process as well as a military process. The political process was centered around bringing the warring partners to a negotiating table to address the social and political issues that are at the heart of the crisis in the DRC. The second part was about military intervention. And military intervention here was not an engagement in war. It was more about trying to keep peace and to ensure that the soldiers on both sides are not engaged in a full-scale war. But that process by the Eastern African Community was derailed by the fact that it coincided with the need for the DRC to go through elections. So it was almost a suspension. But at the same time, there were some people who felt that that intervention was not useful or effective. Hence, the idea of a SADC coming into the picture. So SADC follows closely after the Eastern African Community suspended its engagement. And that engagement was led by the president of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta. Now, with SADC coming in, we saw an escalation instead of a de-escalation of the conflict within the DRC. But right now, with the M23 having decided that it will abide by the calls for ceasefire and cessation of hostility for a moment, it provides an opportunity for these two interventions to meet, to find out what were the weaknesses, what were the strengths of both, and to learn from each other so that the lessons that can be derived from the SADC intervention and Eastern African Community's intervention can actually chart a way forward.
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and former Deputy Vice Chancellor for Institutional Support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. South Africa has the highest number of HIV-positive people in the world, but has also been a success story in terms of treatment and preventing new infections, thanks mostly to the money and the expertise poured into HIV care, a sizable portion of which comes from the U.S. But now, some NGOs that work with HIV-positive communities are in limbo after Washington put a 90-day freeze on aid, while the State Department later added a waiver for life-saving aid. NGOs that had already shut their doors say it is still not clear if this applies to them, and they are worried that this could set back the progress that has been made.
South Africa has the highest number of HIV-positive people in the world, about 8 million, but has also been a huge success story in terms of treatment and preventing new infections. That's largely due to the money poured into expert HIV care here, some 17% of which comes from a U.S. program called the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. But a 90-day foreign aid funding freeze is in effect, following an executive order by U.S. President Donald Trump last month to check if U.S.-funded programs overseas are aligned with U.S. priorities. This has caused some initial confusion in South Africa with healthcare organizations and their patients. Tamsanga Sio, an HIV-positive transgender woman in South Africa, is anxious.
People are frustrated. They live in fear. They don't know what's going to happen. They don't know is whether it's stopped temporary or not temporary.
The Cape Town clinic that Sio used to go to has now been shut for 2 weeks, while the State Department has issued a waiver to continue paying for life-saving services. What that includes remains unclear to many South African organizations that receive funding from PEPFAR. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said this week that the waiver was clear.
If it saves lives, if it's emergency life-saving aid, food, medicine, whatever, they have a waiver. I don't know how much clearer we can be.
The State Department also issued written clarification and guidance on February 1st regarding what activities are and are not covered in the waiver for PEPFAR programs. The South African government says it was blindsided by the US aid freeze, according to Health Minister Aaron Motsoaledi, who convened a meeting about PEPFAR on Wednesday. Motsoaledi also said he has sought clarification on the waiver.
If you say American money cannot be used for LGBTQI+, and we do the counseling and testing, and somebody who falls within that category is transgender, test HIV positive, can they not be helped, even if it's life-saving?
Linda Gale-Becker is a doctor and scientist who heads the Desmond Tutu HIV Center in South Africa.
This sort of is not one homogenous picture. In some places, it's parts of services that have been stopped. In other places, the whole clinic, if it was supplied by PEPFAR, has been closed down.
She goes on to say that some transgender health services have been completely closed, and in other areas, counsellors haven't been able to come in. She also says...
Or a particular service that is no longer available, or some community-based testing or mobile that is stopped. In some places, it is the provision of PrEP and so on and so forth. So it's quite a mixed picture.
The PrEP she's referring to is pre-exposure prophylaxis, a medicine that prevents people at high risk from contracting HIV. Ling Shepherd, who works for Triangle Project, an NGO that provides services for the queer community, says there's a risk of undoing decades of progress.
The impact is devastating. The PEPFAR funding has been a lifeline for millions, and it ensures access to HIV treatment, prevention services, and of course, community-based healthcare. And without it, we are seeing interruptions in medication supply. Clinics are scaling back services, and community health workers have literally been losing their livelihoods.
However, he said, a PEPFAR shortfall will affect training, facilities, and service delivery. The government said it is working on contingency plans that would reduce their dependence on foreign aid in the HIV sector. On Wednesday, a group of health organizations sent a letter to the South African government saying at least 900,000 patients with HIV were directly affected by the US stop work orders. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, February 7th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Aid groups say sexual violence is a constant threat for women inside Sudan's embattled region of Darfur, but refugees tell VOA that it is also a problem for those who have fled the region. Reporting from a refugee camp on Chad's border with Darfur, Henry Wilkins looks at the phenomena of firewood rape.
Chad's border with Darfur, refugees venture out into the scrub to collect firewood. The women say they sometimes travel several kilometres from the refugee camp looking for branches or tree roots to burn for cooking. But so-called firewood rape is an all-too-common occurrence here. This woman says she was out collecting wood when her group was approached by men carrying knives and axes.
We ran away. They caught one of us. I was injured near my waist but got away.
VOA has changed the names and concealed the identity of all the women interviewed in this report to protect them from reprisals. Sexual assault against women collecting firewood is a common phenomenon in refugee camps, according to researchers. For Amina, it seems there is no escape from the threat of sexual violence. Before she fled here, she witnessed other women sexually assaulted by members of the paramilitary rapid support forces who came to her home in Darfur.
They beat and harassed people. They raped and killed. I saw what happened to girls in front of me and old ladies.
Rights groups say they've recorded dozens of rapes of women by RSF-associated militias in Darfur. Fatimata says she and her daughters were victims of the RSF.
They raped me. They raped my daughter, and she died. We don't sleep at night because we are afraid that they will come and kill us. It's a nightmare that never ends.
For these women, whether in the scrub outside the camp or the homes they fled in Darfur, the shadow of sexual violence is ever present. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre, Chad.
The Senegalese government plans to rename public places once named after French colonial figures. According to local media, many streets and buildings in Senegal still bear the names of colonial administrators and French figures. In December, President Bassirou Diomaye Faye announced plans to establish a new government agency tasked with renaming streets and public squares to honor Senegalese personalities. René Lick, a political analyst and the director of CenePlus.com, a U.S.-based media group, tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that the move is long overdue.
The question will be, should be, I guess, how come six decades later we still have all those names? I read this very good French article where the journalist was giving direction to go to the president palace in Dakar, and you have to pass by Jules Ferry, Carnot, Victor Hugo, Vincent Roux. I mean, I can give you the direction with 10 different names of colonial names, basically. So those kind of things, they sound almost radical or revolutionary, where they just common sense. I think what is radical and very surprising is the fact that it haven't been done before. Even if in 1980s, in the 80s, Ibadia Cham, who was the Minister of Education, did make a move in that direction for some schools and all of that. But there's a problem, Douglas, was the way we are going to do that. Are we going to do it in a very participative way, where population will be involved, where it will be based on science, on real history, but not giving names of just local people who are friends or a little bit of a religious small powerhouse next to the neighborhood, where key players of the Pan-African, of the struggle for independence of Senegal are not named yet. So the question is more about how is going to be done that it is important to have it done. Obviously, it's a common sense decision.
There are those who say that these locations named after French colonial figures carry painful historical memories. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You remember Emmanuel Macron, the actual president of France, himself, before he was president, of course, when he was in Algeria, said that colonization is a crime against humanity, which is just, I think, that any person who is not political or who is not, doesn't carry an ideological agenda will recognize. I mean, it's just a simple common sense fact of history. It's crime against humanity, colonization. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to carry those symbols 6 decades after your independence. So I think it makes a lot of sense to make a move like this, but it has to be done in a positive way. It should not be done against the former colonial power. It should not be done against France. It should be done for the people of Senegal, for the history of Senegal, for the symbolism of indigenous dynamics in the country.
There are those who see this as reducing ties with France. Do you share that opinion?
That's more like a political opinion. So I can understand why some people see it that way. But again, I think this is just logic. This is kind of just makes sense. If you were doing a national poll in Senegal, I have no doubt that it will be a Stalinian kind of result where you'll have maybe 90+% of the population saying, yes, this is obviously what we should do. And this is obviously what we should have done 6 decades ago.
That was René Lick, director of CenePlus.com. He spoke with viewers Douglas Mpuga from New York. South Africa will not be bullied, President Cyril Ramaphosa said in a national address on Thursday. This after his government faced criticism from senior U.S. officials, including President Donald Trump. According to the French news agency, the AFP, President Ramaphosa said, quote, "We are witnessing the rise of nationalism, protectionism, the pursuit of narrow interests, and the decline of common cause." Trump asserted this week that South Africa was confiscating land via an expropriation act signed last month, a charge the South African government denies and has described as misinformation. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with football. The Confederation of African Football has announced the date and venue for the quarterfinals draw of the 2024-2025 CAF Champions League and CAF Confederations Cup. The draw will be conducted in Qatar's capital, Doha, on Thursday, the 20th of February, 2025, where CAF will map out the exciting quarterfinal fixtures for both competitions. The quarterfinals of both competitions will be played over two legs, with the first leg of the CAF Champions League scheduled for the 1st to the 2nd of April and 8th to the 9th of April, while the CAF Confederations Cup quarterfinal fixtures are set to take place on the 2nd of April and the 9th of April 2025. Staying with football news, Liberia Football Association President Mustafa Raji has called for a holistic review of the circumstances that led to the death of a 17-year-old footballer, Amara Kamara. Kamara died on January 28, 2025, while en route to Ghana for spinal cord surgery after sustaining an injury during an LFA First Division League match between his club, Blackman Warriors, and Bear Mountain on January 8, 2025. Critics of the Liberia Football Association president's administration has since blamed the football association for failing to ensure medical preparedness at the time of the injury. There was no ambulance at the stadium, forcing Kamara to be transported to Redemption Hospital in a regular vehicle. And now to athletics, where Athletics Kenya Director of Youth and Development, Barnabas Korea, has confirmed that the athletics body has identified 30 potential cases of age cheating, with ongoing investigation revealing disturbing details. The investigation, spearheaded by the World Athletics Integrity Unit, is expected to unveil the extent of the scandal before sanctions are imposed. Korea disclosed that they have already forwarded the names that include Olympic participants and four athletes that were dropped from Team Kenya for the World Under-20 Athletics Championships in Peru last year. Athletics Kenya Director of Youth and Development highlighted that age cheating is more complex than doping, as it involves a network of individuals working together to falsify documents. In mixed martial art news, UFC middleweight champion South Africa's Dricus du Plessis will attempt to defend his middleweight belt for the second time when he meets Sean Strickland in a rematch of their 2024 meeting on Saturday, the 9th of February in Sydney. Strickland rebounded from losing his title with a split decision over former title challenger Paulo Costa at the UFC 302, while still knocks solidify his place as the UFC's middleweight king when he submitted two-time title holder Nigeria-born Israel Adesanya in the main event of UFC 305 in August. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend.
VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
And that's it for this Friday, February 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. And we'll see you again on Monday morning.